to what I just have a kind of a theme in mind. It's not a like a a well worked out logical talk, but rather a set of reflections that I'd want to offer on. I'm not sure, Bill. You mentioned like having a title, but something like the way that the Dharma or the Dharma lessons about language, and it was inspired because when I looked at your website, there's so much clarity in your intention, it seems to, as a Sangha, to find ways to relate to the Dharma in a way that's really useful for everyday life. And so I thought, well, these people have never met me. They have no idea who I am. Thanks to Don, you know that I'm not, that I'm somebody, who might have something to say. But beyond that, like, who is this person, right? And Dawn and I have known each other for 10 years or so, and I'm really appreciative of her. I know she's traveling and giving me a chance, to get to know you. So I'm appreciative of that. So I was inspired by the idea or this, intention you have of bringing Dharma or using Dharma, learning Dharma, relating to Dharma as a way to make our everyday lives maybe richer, more content, more in line with ourselves. As I was thinking about language, because then I said, well, I'm going to be speaking, I'm going to be using language. And so what's the function of language when you're listening to somebody whom you don't know? And that's like I'm speaking. And of course, the Dharma is something which doesn't require you to have faith in me, right? That's not necessary, right? It's nice if you can, because that facilitates faith in other places, but it's actually not necessary, right? The faith, the trust is about having trust in the way that my words affect you and your trust and your capacity to reflect on how it affects you. Because that's where the Sandita Gokaliko and so forth occur, right? It's in the here and now-ness and the of the Dharma, which is basically your experience stream, not mine. So that's nice, because I can, whatever I say will have some impact. If it may put you to sleep, it might make you mad, it might make you happy, whatever it does, but it's then, that's the material that you get to reflect on. And that's wonderful, right? That's the beauty of Dharma, because that it's the awakening is available now in your experience and relating to it in a certain way. So that was my inspiration to think, let me think about language. And so I started thinking and reflecting a little bit about it, and I was couple of things came to mind right away, because we're in a place in our, if you will, country's history or whatever it is we're in, of where there's a lot of language. There's a lot of language. It's not all helpful. It's not all skillful. And in fact, I think probably almost the majority of it isn't. And our response to it then is what? How do we respond to language that isn't probably skillful, with skill, and as an opportunity to be awake to our own experience and to be discerning and responsive, and not just reactive and upset all the time, which is also natural, but it's not the only way we, of course, want to respond. And so, I just wanted to say two things about that. One, just maybe my inspiration. Some of you have probably read this essay by George Orwell. From 1946, called, I think, the Politics of the English Language or something. And there's this famous quote when she says, the political language is designed to make lies sound truthful and murder respectable. And sounds about right. But he goes on in the next part of that phrase, which I also really love. He said it also, political language is designed to give the appearance of solidity to pure wind, to give the appearance of solidity to pure wind. And that's one of my inspirations, because what is it, the impulse in ourselves as much as others, right, to want to give a sense of solidity to pure wind? Is that skillful? Is that useful? I don't know. It's something to reflect on. So that was kind of this is like the bigger context that's in my mind, of how it might be useful to reflect on the way that Dharma teaches us about language. And the other part is just about this moment. And just to share a little bit about the orientation I have to as a so-called teacher, is that I don't see myself really as a teacher. I see myself as a, somebody who's speaking about something, and that facilitates your and mine, while I'm speaking, capacity, turning our attention to the ref to its effect. So it's basically an opportunity to reflect on what's happening, but hopefully with a pointing for you toward your experience. You know, so I'm not, my goal is not to tell you about a bunch of stuff tonight, but rather to like tell you about a bunch of stuff with the intention for you to kind of stay connected, to continue to practice. In the primary attention is on yourself, is on how this affects you. And you may agree or disagree or like or find it sleepy or interesting or whatever. It doesn't matter. It's I mean, it matters a little, but it mostly matters like whether you're awake to those experiences, you know. So that's the other part of language that I wanted to share. You know, so both the larger context in which, you know, I'm well, you know, Marin Sangha is inspired by everyday life, and then, you know, this larger context which we're all living in, whether in Australia or Berkeley, and then, yeah, the way that the Dharma continues to be in, you know, is really here and now. It's not in the future. It's not some other time. It's not in our agreements or disagreements about a point, but rather in like, what is it like to disagree or disagree about a point? So that's my little, you know, kind of an intro and my reflection, my orientation. I'm also going to try to stop myself from speaking in about, in, you know, and so that we have some time to share. I got, I'm a therapist, and one of the I have a consultant who I work with, whom I really love, and she said, if you're ever not sure you're talking too much during a session, she said that the best intervention is to shut up. And I thought that was a really great feedback. You know, it's like, if I'm not sure if I'm talking, to just stop. So I may just stop at some point and then ask you to share. But what I wanted to do is kind of offer a few different ways in which maybe the Dharma teaches us about language and about really communication, because sometimes it's the absence of language, and then maybe just share how, you know, how that affects you and maybe thoughts that you have about your life and practice. And one area is the relationship between communication or language too in general, and the what we learned from in the Dharma about doubt. Because it seems to me, you know, starting out with this Orwell quote, that Orwell, at least then, and I think he might do the same thing now, po would point us to language actually being corrosive in its communicative function, you know, that it actually makes us more fearful, more disconnected. It makes us seem have a sense of becoming reactive, and our reactivity becoming useful to people who want power. So that's something I think that we want to be sensitive to, you know. So one aspect, and this is a kind of doubt, or that's one kind of communication. Another kind of way in which communication is helpful when we doubt, say, the connection between a word and a meaning, like a word and a reference, which of course, you know, totalitarian figures, authoritarians want to disconnect language from meaning, language from reference, so that it's not possible to communicate anymore, right? To take away our capacity to have solidarity, to have connection with one another, because we don't trust that language works. That we can't use it. That's a kind of very corrosive doubt. The other way in which, though, having doubt about the connection between meaning and language is also, it can be very helpful, right? Because we can get pretty convinced about our own points. You know, like we are seeing the decline of American democracy. Like that phrase, you know, okay, it may be true, but it's so full of assumptions, you know, about things that it we can just get stuck in the reactivity. Are we really communicating something important to ourselves? Are we really connecting with one another? Or is the phrase full of assumptions? And so then a sense of doubt about the connection between those words and meaning is very helpful, because it really helps us to reflect on whether what we're saying is what we want to say, or whether it's just a kind of spouting someone else's point, saying a bunch of shibboleths, whatever, right? But it allows us to enter into a more critical, which is to say, self-reflective relationship with language. And so I wanted to offer just to connect this very concretely to the Dharma, and things probably, you know, can, lessons you already know, but just to kind of make the, to open the association stream here a little bit. So it, there is a kind of corrosive doubt that can be facilitated by language. And I'm sure many of you are aware of the teaching the Buddha had when he was interacting about metaphysical questions. Sometimes he would engage around metaphysical questions, but sometimes he wouldn't. And in the most famous case, which often discussed, is this conversation with I think it's called the Ananda Sutta, when she's talking with Visagotā, right, about whether or not there's eternity, or whether there's going to be a self after death or not, whether the Buddha will exist. And he's when they and he's asked these questions three times. Well, is there going to be a self? There's not, and he doesn't answer. And of course, the wandering ascetic gets frustrated because he won't answer his questions about these really important, pressing philosophical questions, and he leaves. And so then, and Ananda then asks the Buddha. He said, "Well, why didn't you answer?" And he says, "Well, if I had said that there is going to be an eternity to the Tathagata, to this to the to me, it would have encouraged him to a kind of eternalistic view. And if I said there hadn't been, then he would have thought of there's some kind of more a nihilistic view." And so I just chose to be silent, because any speech was going to confuse him. It would have contributed to more delusion. So here's a case where the Buddha recognized, obviously he was talking about the main lesson here in this teaching is about the value to practice of metaphysical questioning, right? That's of course important. But what I also am hearing in this, in him saying, what's the function of language, of communication? How do I communicate best here? Is it with language that's going to create confusion, or with silence that at least won't do any harm? And I think it's a really interesting, reflection on the more corrosive form of doubt, or the most corrosive form of language, when language gets disconnected from its function. In this case, to help somebody practice, somebody get awake, not figure out whether there's an eternity to the self or not. So that's an example of where it seems like the Dharma really speaks to the possibility of language as a corrosive, possibly at least the disconnection between language and function, its communicative function, is corrosive. Then I have this memory. I was trying to dig up for y'all some kind of illustration of when it's not corrosive, and but actually what came to mind was this wonderful Emily Dickinson letter. Some of you may have remembered, she wrote a letter. She was writing to Otis Lord, I think, in like 1860 some point, and she was talking about her faith in various things. She was talking about a relationship with him and other things, but in this letter, there's this wonderful phrase. She said, on subjects, I actually wrote this one down. She said, on subjects of which we know nothing, or should I say beings, we both believe and we disbelieve 100 times an hour, which keeps believing nimble. So we both believe and disbelieve 100 times an hour, which keeps believing nimble. I love that, because it points to, this sense of doubt, a practicing of doubt that actually supports faith. That by wondering, by questioning our own belief in this, any kind of sentence like "I love you," or "I think so and so politician stupid," or whatever it is. That if we question, you can still say it, right? But if you question the belief 100 times an hour, it doesn't necessarily lead to having no meaning. It actually leads to a much deeper sense of what it's like to believe. If we are constantly practicing this experience of believing and disbelieving, and to me, the Dharma is like that. I don't know what your meditation just now was like, but at least I went through believing and disbelieving a bunch of times. Am I awake? Am I aware? What's going on? But this questioning can lead to a lot of confusion, but it also can lead to a kind of an openness of letting go into a different kind of faith. So this is a sort of a non-corrosive form to me of in which communication and language are still disconnected, but in a way that leads onward, to leads to a more nimble form of believing. So that's one area. I'm just connecting language, the disconnection of language and meaning, to the Buddhist teaching on doubt. corrosive and onward leading doubt. And another one is, is more obvious around, the use of wise speech. And we one of the most illuminating part of the Dharma for me when I first found out about it was this whole teaching around wise speech. Because being from California, I grew up in Petaluma, and which was actually at that time a fairly traditional town, but there was still a lot of, impulse to speak whatever was on your mind. Like that was the era, in the 1970s I grew up, you say what's on your mind. That's what's genuine and authentic. And so when I read that, oh, well, you can say what's on your mind if it's true, but also if it happens to be timely and useful and kind, I was like, wow, that's new. That's a new addition to the impulse to constantly speaking whatever is on your mind. I said, I like that. And it made a lot of sense to me that I didn't have to say everything that was on my mind if I didn't find it useful to me and others, or particularly kind. Or and so there's a way in which that was very interesting to me. So, do I use language in a way that is why? What do I use language for? And I remember soon after, learning about wise speech was some years after that. And I was sitting in a cafe. At that time, I lived in San Francisco, and I was listening to these two people who I don't think knew each other. They seemed to just be chatting. They were talking about the weather. And I was, rudely overlooked listening to their conversation, and they're talking about the weather. And I noticed like getting all judgy about it. It's like, oh, it's so superficial. They're just talking about the weather. Is this so silly? And I listened on. And then, and I started noticing something that I hadn't noticed before, that they were really interested in one another. They were talking about, they started talking a little bit about this and that. It was all small talk. It all seemed sort of trivial. But then I looked at them, and I looked over at the, and they were really engaged with one another. And I thought, wow, the weather is an opportunity for them to connect. It was, they're going to probably never see each other again. And I really loved this challenge to a kind of written, then very rigid view of what wise speech was. So the weather itself, I suspect, wasn't that important to them, but it was. Maybe it was, right? But it mostly in their connection, it seemed to be a way for them in this casual encounter to connect with one another, and it really opened me a little bit to my kind of, well, sanctimony, obviously, but also to, to being a little bit more flexible about what, say, small talk might, how it might function if somebody, especially if we're really aware of it. And I don't know to what degree they were self-reflective about talking about something that seemed kind of trivial, but in my heart, I was really open to the possibility that there we can talk about seemingly trivial things in ways that are not trivial at all, because it has to do with connection with one another. And a couple little anecdotes, again, a teaching that it came to mind right away when, in this case, when I thought of that and thinking about wise speech, that kind of went to more to the purpose of speech in the Buddha's teachings, was around harmony. The use of speech to promote harmony. And I don't know if, and I'll just broaden the center of harmony to see the connection with one another, to really have connection with one another. And again, there's this wonderful teaching in which the Buddha goes to visit Aniruddha, is one of his disciples, and Aniruddha is hanging out in a park with two other monks, and they're practicing. And the Buddha goes and it's kind of sweet teaching, because as the Buddha goes into the park of the ranger or whatever you want to call it, this person, like, ah, oh, don't go there, it's because there's these monks practicing and they would like to have solitude. And Aniruddha happily kind of overhears this and says, no, this is our teacher. We really want to see him. So he goes in, and the whole conversation, and some of you may be familiar with this too, is about their interactions with one another. And the, among other things, the Buddha is curious about how they're all getting along, like what's going on. And Aniruddha and the other two would confirm this. They said, we're really feeling a lot of harmony. And the Buddha said, well, how do you achieve harmony? And Aniruddha and then the others two confirm, say, well, when we have an idea and it doesn't seem to kind of jive with the other's ideas, we just set it aside and we just choose harmony over discord. And the others just say, yeah, that's what we do. And then the Buddha said, well, oh, that's great. And he said, how are you dealing with your alms rounds and going out in the community, and when any of you have any needs, how's that going? They said, well, that's going great. And he said, well, how's that working? He said, well, when one person goes out for alms rounds, if one person isn't doing well, we make sure that everything's set up so that when they get back, there's a seat for them and everything's fine. And so again, this is a, to me, a teaching on, to some degree, one could say setting aside ideas, setting aside what we care about, which would be unhelpful in daily life, because like, well, I do have opinions that matter, and I do have things that I want to say, but it definitely points to me, at least, to this other purpose for communicating that isn't about convincing other people of me being right or my idea being better, but rather keeping in mind, which is a discernment practice, our interest in harmony or our interest in connection over disconnection. And I think this, to me, at least as a person in this world, is one of the most inspirational but challenging practices, because I have lots of opinions about stuff, and I'm sure you all, I suspect, do too, and some of these opinions are actually worth hearing. Right, some of them aren't, but some of them really are, and often, probably all of us are more right about what's going on in the world right now than the people in power. So shouldn't we be saying that, And I don't know. I don't know the answer, but there is this discernment practice, right? That seems available to all of us when we connect to, you mentioned earlier the paramis, when we connect to these wholesome qualities of heart as the motivator, and I love this teaching for that. That when we turn to motivations like, kindness and connection, then we will speak in a new way. And then lastly, before I stop, I'm actually not doing bad here with time, I think. I just wanted to maybe bring in more, even more broadly, the broadly the function of mindfulness, because and language and communication, because at least in my experience, in my own life and as a psychotherapist, there's a lot of ways in which language is used or asked to be used in ways that is about telling other people or myself about what's wrong with me, and or why I'm feeling the way I'm feeling. Or in other words, a lot of pressure to be coherent to myself, to make myself available in a coherent way to others, which can be helpful. But I think that there is a way in which there's this pressure to be coherent bypasses the this sense that language isn't able to communicate who I am. It isn't able to communicate what is going on right now in each of our experiences or what's happening together. I mean, this moment together right now, with I don't know how many of us are here together, like 20 people or something, it's almost infinitely complex, infinitely complex. So much going on in our own systems, in between us, our thoughts about each other, thoughts about other things that are going on. The fact that I'm speaking in English and presumably you're hearing that and more or less understanding it, meaning that we all learned English. And we're determined by it. It's unbelievable how complex what is going on right now is, and the sense that that went to be connected to reality is about really knowing clearly in a coherent way that's available to language what is going on is a deep delusion, because the interconnectedness that we have is not something that we can actually place in language in this very discriminatory thing that breaks things up. And I've been inspired by the psychoanalyst Donald Winnicott, and he in a wonderful essay in the 19 I think in the 1950s or early 60s had said that the main the way the best way to describe the self is that which cannot be and what should never be communicated. So whatever the self is for him, and this is a psychological self, you know, some kind of core who I am, is that which should be allowed to go on forever silent. He even compared it to the music of the spheres. That's the language that's possible for something like the self. So even the psychological self, so that for those like Winnicott, who really deeply thought about and related to the sensitivity and complexity and sort of ineffableness of being human, was something that was fundamentally silent in the relationship to language. And that to me, you know, is such a beautiful Dharma teaching about what is it like to put our faith not in, you know, our ability to communicate precisely who I am or what's going on, but rather in the awareness of what's going on, which has been the invitation, you know, tonight for all of us to kind of stay connected to that, whatever I'm saying, you know, but also to really stay connected to your awareness of to this intuitive capacity to know what's going on without it being, without all the pressure to telling me or anyone else or yourself even, like, it's this is what it's like in the following language. And this is a both very forgiving and I think realistic way of viewing ourselves, but also an onward leading one, you know, because it doesn't ask us to, you know, make wind into something solid, which is precisely what it means when we're asked to, you know, tell somebody who you are, is asking that. So in language, I'm not saying you aren't somebody, you are, of course, but to put it in language, you know, is to kind of participate in that kind of political language that asks us to make solid what is not, at least in the way that we're asked to make it available. So I'm going to stop there and hope that we have a few minutes to share. I just appreciate your listening and would love to hear, you know, both any reflections on your practice, how, you know, any of this resonates for you, or your own reflections on language and dharma and truth.
Can you just explain what you mean by political language? I was a little stuck on that.
It's a word that Orwell used. And so Orwell, you said that political language, he decided political language, he said, this is again in 1946 after the end of World War II and, you know, a lot going on. He said that political language, and he was very polemical. He was, and I, so I'm assuming he's talking about, and the examples he's using in this essay are of people who are political figures speaking. And he's saying it's, and the way he was saying at that time that for him, what he observes as political language is language that's quite flowery, that's not very precise. And he's calling for people to speak in a way that's more concise, precise. I'm not saying that's what we should be doing now. I'm not sure he would even say that. So, but it is a language that is being used, I think, for him, and I was referring to it as well, a language of power, you know, a language that's supposed to be describing the way, you know, things are supposed to be. You know, my ideology is the one you should understand and accept. You should do what I think, meaning you all, not just, you know, on the screen, but like in this room, but everybody. So I think at the time he meant anybody who was speaking as a politician who want, made a claim to thinking that they should have more power than other people or they're more right than other people, and that's what justified, you know, being in power. I hope that answers the question. Yeah.
I'll talk.
Thank you.
I was thinking about definitions and in terms of the Sangha and Dharma. I've been fascinated with the redefining of the word concentration. When I first started studying Dharma, it meant one thing, and now here in 2025, it means some different things. And I'm loving that we don't actually know what was meant by samadhi when it was written down. We've just sort of implied it, inferred it. So when you talk about communicating, I think definitions sometimes get in the way.
Nice. Can you say more? I love what you're saying. Say more about how that has affected you to kind of see the morphing, evolving of its meaning.
I've been thrilled, I'll just say. When I first started, it was one-pointed shine your flashlight on the subject. And for me, it was a lot of effort. Really focus your mind and become concentrated. And now it's far more gather and unify, more relaxed. So
Nice.
I see a multi-year change.
So I hear like two things in what you're saying, which are really great. I mean, both the change specifically in that term, that has actually allowed you, it sounds like, to be more open to the possibility of practicing samadhi, or this more consistent and consonant with the way you relate to it. That's wonderful. And then secondly, just the kind of the way in which Dharma language, like all languages, just maybe the underlying tone, theme of what I'm trying to say tonight is a pointing. It's not a, I mean, at least that's what I'm kind of conjecturing. It's a sort of a pointing, and not a claim. I would, or at least I would posit that we might be able to, reflect on it as a pointing toward, rather than as a, a term that we can get really wrapped up in having a specific meaning, which leads invariably, because not everybody's going to agree with any meaning, to conflict, and then what is the function of these definitions? I'm really appreciating both of your points, if I'm following you. Maybe just I'm trying to follow who is next. Oh, I think you
It's
were.
generally it's displayed in order of when people clicked. So
Thank you.
since I clicked next, I just wanted to emphasize because I suspect that not everybody here has read the George Orwell essay. I think it's one of the most important documents from the 20th century. So anybody who hasn't read it, I really, really urge you to go out and get it. All of his essays are brilliant, but many of them are on fairly trivial topics. But this one is really, really important and brilliantly written, not only for its content, but it's a great demonstration of how to write a good essay. But the topic itself is just really, really important. That's all I've got.
Thank you, Paul. Let's see then. Next person,
I guess
I'm
I
trying to
can
find
talk. I just wanted to
it.
say I really appreciated your talk, especially about the limits of language, because if you begin to get involved with I am this and you are that, you not only produce a lot of discord, but you also produce a lot of attachments to these ideas, which leads straight to deep dukkha and all kinds of other very bad and nasty things. Oops, I'm being too precise here. But I really think that's so important, and it has so much to do with mindfulness and humility. Being able to say, yes, I'm pointing at this, but I don't know. Everyone is a mystery, and to have respect for that mystery and celebrate the mystery.
Barbara, thank you. Yeah, I totally agree with you. And we're stuck in this place, though, where there are things that matter to us, and then how do we balance that, the things that really matter to us, and whether you're in a Dharma conversation or a political one or a personal one, that, and I hear what you're saying, that there's so much discernment in feeling the energy, like the, because you just named it, right? Like how much self is there in my energy when I'm trying to communicate something? Because it really matters, right? It's gonna depend on whether it leads to dukkha or whether it leads to confound concord. And I see your. Barbara, were you gonna follow up?
Oh, there. I don't know if, yeah, I sort of said it. I think what you said really well, and there's a lot of self there. There are some times you just want to say, this is wrong. No, we're not going to let you kick a, judge a 2-year-old and take them out of the country. I mean, at a certain point, you do make a statement, but it's specific and precise to the situation, too, and it's not a generalization like, who am I in the
Yeah.
same way?
There's really my experience in practice is that there, I think people who have hear about a sense of Buddhism being pacifistic because we don't take positions on anything, right? Misunderstand the, well, I don't know if it's misunderstand, but maybe haven't practiced in such a way as to see that discernment is still possible, right? That clarity of view is possible. that isn't about, trying to force my view on someone else. And in my experience, the more I've practiced and the more I've been less likely to need to convince somebody that I'm right, even though I can clearly see, a wrong, and so I don't feel like I'm adding a lot of extra force or violence to a situation that already is wrong, and that's I'm definitely imperfect in that area, right? But to me, the practice has supported me enormously in being able to discern the intention behind the speech, which is, really different when I'm, no, you've got to understand, you've got to see it my way versus like, this is wrong. And I'm clear on that right now. The different energy. Liz?
Hi, thank you. I like Sylvia Boorstein's acronym, WAIT. Why am I talking? I'm trying to remember that more. I find that I'm quite old now, and I've gone through extreme changes in the last 2 to 3 years. And I've been practicing Buddhism for 35 years. My idea, again, very much like Jan, concept that I learned years ago, I have changed radically during my time of practice. What we learned 30 years ago has changed. I've changed so much, and my mind is very fluid now. It seems to be changing daily. What I see, what I learn. I don't know who I am from day to day. And I'm finding that fascinating, a bit disturbing, but on the other hand, it's quite a marvelous trip. And so language, is appearing through in that. But mostly what's changing is my ability to listen and concepts. And also I'm fascinated by your journey from an attorney to a psychologist. That may be, did I get that right, Brett?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Well, talk about language from one profession to another, that's a radical change. So I'm just in process. So concepts are in process, and what I think is in process, and it's quite an exciting journey that I think is a result of Buddhist practice.
Thank you, Liz. Yeah, I was a just as an I was a literature professor, a German literature professor before I was a lawyer. So maybe there's a detour in all kinds of weird language canoes. But Liz, I just really inspired by what you're saying. Like, because it's interesting to hear you talk, right? Because on one hand, you've changed. On the other hand, you're being so clear about you don't know who you are, and yet you're just being very clear right now. And at least I feel your clarity about your current experience. So that's really wonderful, and it shows the fruit of practice. Thank you.
Thank you. It's an astonishing journey. I'm glad I lived long enough to see
I know we're almost at time, but I think Patty, you were gonna say something, and then maybe we can close.
Thank you so much, Brett. I just want to share that as I get older, I realize that wise speech is often silence. It's often much more wise to keep my mouth shut. And I also love that quote that's attributed to both Abraham Lincoln and what's his name? Mark Twain. One of them said, better to keep your mouth shut and let people suspect you're a fool than to open it and remove all doubt.
Well, you proved them wrong by just saying what you said. So